Let us start today with a short meditation. Let the body be perfectly at ease, comfortable, elastic. Let all the muscular strains ease off. Just breathe easily and gently. Let the head be very delicately poised upon the neck. No strain in the neck muscles or the facial muscles. And let that rhythm of the breath be established. Just be quietly aware of the breath entering the nostrils and the rhythmic movement of the diaphragm. Now, this which we commonly call the breath rhythm is really the life rhythm of the whole psychophysical being. And let that life rhythm permeate the entire being. Life in its perfection and in its fruition is a pure rhythm. Let the attention be as much attuned as possible to this rhythm. Let the sense of stillness and silence permeate the whole being, remembering that it is a moving stillness and an eloquent silence. It is moving, it is eloquent, because one is alive. Now perhaps we are ready to consider very carefully this body, which we commonly call my body. Just be very aware of it. It's made up of elements, fundamental elements, which are the common world stuff. Today we would use the chemical terms, hydrogen and oxygen and iron and phosphorus and so on. In the old days they talked of fire, air, earth, water, and what, for lack of a better word, we term ether, akasha as they called it. Just made up of these elements. And these elements are taken in by the body, incorporated into the body, and they move out of the body. Nothing permanent. It's a continuous inflow and outflow. Let us be clearly aware of the fact, not merely intellectually say in so many words, the body consists of elements which enter and leave the body. Be very much aware of the fact, a living process. And in the light of that awareness, let us consider this peculiar phrase we use, my body, in a proprietary sense. Is this body my property? Look into this proprietariness in our own mind with respect to the body and see how intimately it is tied up with our vanity, our egoism, our greed. The body as property entails all these. Now, if we can look at the body intelligently, it will be easier to free ourselves from this proprietary sense over the body and consequent attachment and bondage to the body, because whatsoever is property, to that one is tied, one is bound. The body being property, we are bound to the vanity, the egoism, the greed, and many other things associated with it. But if we are freed of this property sense with respect to the body, we become considerably, if not altogether, freed from so much that is a trouble and a petty thing in our lives. The vanities, the greeds, the consequent frustrations often, or the satisfactions as they may be, and the resentment, envy, ill will, everything that gets associated with the bodily process. The comparing oneself with another. What is it that he has which I haven't, or she has which I haven't? One becomes free of that burden. And with it, free of a whole burden of anxiety. We have to work very hard seeing this. But if we can see it, we will see what actually emerges. Something which is in tune with life itself and the rhythm of life. And therefore, with all that power which brings each individual to fruition, to fulfillment, and that is the sense of trusteeship with respect to the body. This body is not my property. It came out of the earth, it came out of the whole world, and back to the world it goes. But there is a purpose, a place in the great pattern of things to be fulfilled. And if I have a sense of trusteeship with respect to the body, then at last I can begin to care for the body, treat it, deal with it, make it act in a right and harmonious way. Free of possessiveness, free of all the unhappy things that are associated with possessiveness. Now one can take true joy in being alive. The joy will be there naturally. One is alive, one is living, which means actually fulfilling one's destiny, one's particular destiny in the pattern of life. And try and see what happens in consequence. Our self-concern are almost total preoccupation with self and self-affairs. Our self-orientation in life, which raises up all through our life that terrible duality, that conflicting duality of self and not self, that goes out. Does not the body then find it easier to be pure, to be clean, strong and healthy? The true temple of the divine. And if one is really sensitive to that, there is no vanity or egoism involved in it. If one is falsely aware of it, that is to say, in intellectual terms only, this body is the temple of the divine, there is conceit and pride and folly. But in the pure awareness, egoism, vanity, impurity are out. This body is not property. And it is senseless to be possessive in relation to it. And now let us try and see one of the tremendous consequences of this. Our possessive hold, or our attempt, conscious and unconscious, to have a possessive hold over other bodies also vanishes. Then there can be freedom and right relationship between oneself and everyone around. A background of right relationship, as far as oneself can self-responsibly establish that relationship. And this is very important. See this very clearly, because then oneself is not guilty of contributing towards conflict with those whom we meet. Non-possessiveness of the organism. Then it is much easier to be harmless. And if there is non-possessiveness with respect to the body, it is also very much easier to be non-possessive with respect to all our queer ideas about our own minds or souls or spirits or whatever it is. Then there is freedom, and one can be aware of the one total reality of life in its wholeness, in its beauty and harmony. And he who can live in that awareness, at peace within himself, at peace with others and his environment, is veritably a god on earth, a deva. Just see that very quietly, very simply. And just let go of grasping, this possessive grasping of the body. That is all. Let that awareness just suffuse the mind, and let us quietly consider together one very important question, problem. Religion, in the deep and pure sense with which we are concerned, has nothing to do with solving our personal problems. Nothing at all. It is when religion is stepped down to the plane of worldliness, and therefore of living in terms of isolative self-consciousness, that the superficial thing that passes under the name of religion is utilized, or one attempts to utilize it, to solve personal problems. The context of religion is transcendence, the one total reality, whatever it is, whatever it may be. The context of personal problems is the unawakened, the unenlightened consciousness, which always functions enclosed within the realm of duality in conflict. That is the realm of personal problems. Do try and follow this very, very carefully and intensely. If the religious mind, the religious consciousness is strong in us, that isolative self-consciousness is not there, and therefore there is no such thing as a personal problem for us. Don't misunderstand this. Circumstance, life, the process of life, the becoming process, will always present challenges, because the becoming process functions primarily in a dualistic mode. It will always throw up challenges to us. But if we let ourselves get caught in awareness, in inner consciousness, in that condition of duality and conflict, then the problems become personal problems. There is a self-orientation, and there is always self in enmity with not-self. But if there is the religious mind in the true sense, there is a pure mind which can deal rightly with every problem that comes up. And in order to deal rightly with every problem that comes up, one has to be in such a state that that problem never becomes a personal problem. It is a problem. It has appeared. One deals with it. Without making it, without letting it become a personal problem. This requires tremendous wide awakeness all the time, and very great intelligence, very clear perception all along the line, all through the day. Because you know how easy it is to be caught napping. If the stimulus of the circumstance is sufficiently strong against us, then we forget. And we slide down from the state of a complete awareness, a whole awareness, to the limited, dualistic, conflicting consciousness. To maintain this wide awakeness is the one and only thing to which all one's energies are bent, if one is interested in, concerned with, living religiously. And never forget that living religiously essentially means living humanly. Living irreligiously means living subhumanly. We are neither human nor are we good animals. It is for that reason that man, the race of man alone, is capable of, and unhappily too often is, bestial. In the quiet with oneself, when one is with oneself, look into this and see how below, within the depths of the mind, subconsciously, unconsciously, we do approach religion with the desire that it will solve our problems. But this can never come about in any real satisfactory sense. Religion cannot do that sort of thing. Why? Because, subconsciously at least, what we mean by solving our problems is just this, that this particular shape of things which actually prevails here now is something I don't like, and I want it to be such and such a shape instead. Now, I, the ignorant, the impure, the dualistic, the conflicting, the incapable, unskilled, I, who am this sort of person, am trying to predetermine, preconceive the perfect shape, which is perfect fulfillment, perfect happiness, fruition, and all the rest of it. Is it possible? Either humanly or subhumanly? Not at all. It never can be the case. Look into our own lives and see how all along the line we try to alter the shape of things according to heart's desire. And heart's desire is stupid, ignorant, tainted, unskilled, incapable. It is not in tune with life itself. It is life. It is the unknown, the mysterious, the transcendent, which releases perfection, beauty, harmony, loveliness, in the real sense, not in our distorted sense. We have not the vision for that. What we can do is to see what is the distortion within ourselves. See it quite clearly. And in the seeing quite clearly, that which is distorted undistorts. It disentangles, unravels, and life in freedom, unhindered by me, brings me to fruition and fulfillment. How do you think this body lives? Is it because I plan and dictate and work out ways and means and techniques how it shall live? It is alive by virtue of the power of life in it, this mysterious something, life, which I don't know. When I meddle with life's processes, then I suffer for it and pay the penalty. And then I say, oh, I don't like this. And I talk about the injustice of God or fate or all the rest of it. Isn't that true? Now, how much more so that is true with respect to what we call mind? We use this word mind. We talk of ourselves as a psychophysical organism. Do we know what psyche is? What mind is? We use the word very confidently every day of our lives, don't we? But we don't know what it is. We know it immeasurably less than we know what we call the body. And I'll suggest that even where the body is concerned, we don't know just what the body is. Our knowledge of the body, our acquaintance with it, is restricted to our sense impressions, which are translated by the brain, which already is a conditioned brain, conditioned from infancy by parents, teachers, friends, and our circumstance. And we fondly, foolishly imagine that we know the body. We have a bundle of sense impressions about the body, but we don't know the body. What we really know, we never misuse. When we really know something, we do not fail to deliver the goods, to do the right thing. If a pianist really knows the piece he is going to play, he plays it beautifully, makes music with it. Do I know the body in that sense? So what happens to the body? So even this body with which we identify ourselves so much, which we constantly use and which we think we know and all the rest of it, we have hardly begun to know. Now, if we are religious minded, we do not rush to the nearest bookshop and buy up all the books on anatomy and physiology in order to know the body. There we acquire knowledge about the body, knowledge as discovered by scientists. But if you and I, as living human beings, really wish to know the body, then, in this religious sense, I mean, wish to know it in that sense, then let us fully wake up to the fact that we don't know. And in fully waking up to one's own ignorance, that awakening means that wisdom has slipped into place where there was ignorance before. Why do we not see this clearly and live by it? You see, we are so obsessed with this possessiveness, this acquisitiveness, just as we have this sense of possessiveness with respect to the body, and the sense of acquisitiveness with respect to bodily things and experiences and objects and so forth. We have the same possessiveness and acquisitiveness with respect to knowledge, either superficially or in the depths. We want to acquire the knowledge of the body. We can never acquire the knowledge of the body in that profound religious sense. In the scientific sense, we can, yes. Your expert, the doctor, he's supposed to know about all about the body. He has acquired the knowledge of the body. How many doctors are masters of their bodies, have healthy bodies, use their bodies rightly? How many? 1, 2, 3? That would be a multitude in the world. So you see how personal problems creep in into our lives, and how easily we go the wrong way with respect to personal problems. If I tackle any one personal problem as a personal problem, I may alter the shape of that particular situation, or, having got rid of that, I will pile on my head probably about 3 or 4 other personal problems. Why? Because I am possessive and acquisitive in my dualistic condition. In my self-oriented condition. Take this into a slightly subtler sphere. One's duties. One has responsibilities. One is in an office, in the government, in the educational world, or whatever it is. Or one is a dustman, or whatever it is. One has duties. Now, in the name of duty, how do we act? Again, somewhat, if not considerably, possessively, acquisitively. These are my duties. I have a strong self-respect which demands that those duties shall be properly fulfilled. And as long as I fulfill my duties in the awareness and consciousness of isolative self, then I will always fulfill them in dualistic and conflicting terms, and sow the seeds of fresh trouble. You remember some weeks ago we went into this a little bit. No conflict does anything but sow the seeds of further conflict. This whole business of taking sides. You have a dualistic situation, or you have a situation of multiplicity. And one takes sides with this against that. Because this is the side of honor, justice, freedom, goodness, and all the rest of it. And that is the side of all that is the opposite, as we say, of honor, justice, freedom, and whatnot. And then we are out to win at any price, at any cost. And look at the methods. The methods are always destructive. Always productive of misery and sorrow to somebody somewhere. And then we say at last the cause of freedom and justice has won. Now the millennium will begin. And next day the next conflict begins. And that is all. Isn't this everlastingly man's story? But it begins and proceeds entirely in my own very being. And this is what I've got to see. And I've got to free myself completely from this extraordinary conceit that I, already a raging battlefield, can go out and help others and produce harmony and beauty elsewhere. I'm going to flash the torch of blackness upon the dark spots and enlighten them. That's what I'm trying to do, am I not? But you see, the religious mind sees these things, can really see them. Because the religious mind is the unselfed mind, the selfless mind. This doesn't mean a mind which neglects the self, which hurts the self, which does wrong to oneself. Not that. The religious mind is fully awake to self-responsibility and is free from the illusion of separateness from the totality. This is the religious mind. And because of the freedom from that illusion, then whatsoever the religious-minded one does for himself, he does as unto all others. Whatsoever he does for any other or several others is done as for himself. Not by any false self-identification, but by a clear vision of the actual nature of things and of reality as it is. And you see, once that wells up within one's own consciousness, you will find that there is extraordinary joy and strength with it. Not the joy which is unbalanced emotionalism, not excitement, but immense power wells up. I said it wells up within oneself. Let us not misinterpret this in the sense that I have that power and am releasing it. Not at all. The one and only power functions freely and easily through oneself because one is unresisting. So, look into this very carefully. Religion is not for solving personal problems. When one has really seen that, and one is free from this personalistic enclosure, then living religious-mindedly will so transform oneself and one's environment that what the world commonly experiences and deals with as personal problems will just disappear. Other problems will come, but they will be problems, not my problems, not your problems, but problems, just problems. And if one is awake to the fact of problems as problems, without mine and thine involved in it, then the power of problems to defeat life's purposes disappears. Because in that awareness of relationship of totality, these transcendent realities which we call compassion, wisdom, considerateness, and so forth, all function freely and easily. You may remember some time ago we tried to see that when there is freedom from taking sides, then one can examine the whole situation. Otherwise, there is only a partial examination. That's what makes us impartial in relation to both conflicting parties. But if one is quite impartial within oneself and does not take sides, then one can examine everything and begin to understand the whole situation. And in that, and out of that, there emerges the transformation of that situation. And its state of disharmony can change into a state of harmony without sowing seeds of further conflict. Bear that in mind. This is very difficult, mind you. Of course it is difficult. Don't we know it throughout our lives? It is very difficult. But if you want to be a fine concert pianist, if you want to be a really great engineer, or the first successful Chancellor of the Exchequer in history — history has never produced anybody who knows how to do the country's housekeeping — if you want to be that, don't ask for a cushy job. It's tremendously difficult, of course it is. No less a person than Beethoven said, it's only 5% inspiration, 95% is perspiration. Hard work. Hard work. That is why those who are involved in superficial religion, they go participate in rituals and piously say, "O Lord God," etc., etc., and having gone through the pretty gestures, like Louis XIV and his court dancing the pretty steps of the minuet, then the Lord God is supposed to do all the rest for you. Do remember, the Lord God is completely deaf. I am beginning to approach that stage because I am partially deaf. The Lord God cannot hear our language. He can hear divine language. He knows all about that. And he hears it before you speak it. And that divine language comes out of the religious mind, not out of the worldly mind, caught up in dualistic conflict. This is very important. So, let go. No possessiveness, no acquisitiveness. Start with the body, the thing you can't get rid of until it gets rid of you one fine day. Start with the body and take it into every aspect of life and see what happens when this graspingness has gone. You see the tremendous implications of the Buddha's statement? Ananda, the freedom of consciousness, cetto, the freedom of consciousness, of mind, from all grasping, is indeed nirvana. Now, just one other little point. Perhaps it's a big point. The mind that is free this way, the religious mind is a free mind. The mind that is free this way is power in action. This power, which is amoral, beyond our dualistic good and evil, is the meaning of the word virtue. This is your soul strength. And it is this virtue which is released into activity in whatsoever you do, if one is aware in non-dualistic terms, and therefore not tied to separate personality. You may remember I suggested a long time back, that a useful way to regard the mind is to regard it as the receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the living organism, oneself. That's one way of looking at it. There is the other aspect. This aspect is, you may say if you like, a personal aspect, because it is the sensitivity characterizing the particular living organism, the finite living organism. There is another aspect. Just as the stuff of the body comes out of the storehouse of the universal stuff and goes back to that universal storehouse, there is the universal aspect of mind. And this is energy, this is power. Immense power, unknown, immeasurable, dimensionless, beyond analysis, beyond conception, can never be grasped. It is all these things. Now, this power is the real meaning of the word virtue. That is virtue. So now, as long as we function in the sphere of self-oriented, conflicting duality, this virtue is hindered. It is distorted. It is spoilt. And it manifests in our lives in this ambivalent way of virtuous vicious. You get it? Now you will see that virtue, in the real sense, the transcendent sense, can never be sought, can never be acquired. Virtue, in the dualistic sense, we can acquire, just as we can acquire a new jacket or a new overcoat and put it on. But that is not the jacket and overcoat are not the truth of my own living body. People display their virtues and try to suppress their vices, to hide them from sight. Just as we may have a very smart jacket which hides a somewhat tattered vest underneath it. It's a little bit like that. But if one opens out in awareness to the one total reality and is awake in those transcendent terms, then this virtue, which is the power of mind, which is the power of life also in terms of manifestation, will function quite easily. And one's life will be virtuous. if I can give total and complete attention to what is here and now, then whatsoever happens through me, the living existent, is virtuous. So you will see that in this profound real sense, there is no meaning to a statement that of this sort, that I am virtuous. The I can never be virtuous. It can only obstruct virtue. So one never struggles for virtue if one is religious-minded and intelligent. You don't struggle for virtue. Just remain awake, watchful, fully awake, and virtue will work itself through you. You see the freedom involved in that, associated with that. The peace, the strength, the happiness, the pure happiness of it. So now you see the real meaning of the teaching, the immemorial teaching, that the virtuous man is the happy man, misinterpreted by the millions in the world as he who practices virtue in this ambivalent sense is going to have a pleasant life, a charming life, nice circumstances, and everything to fit in with heart's desire. Nothing of the sort. Now you see how people have accused, through the centuries people have done this, people who are really blind inwardly. They have said that the religious teachers lead you only into a miserable life. But let those who accuse the religious teachers in that way produce their evidence of having led mankind into the unmiserable life, the happy life. Then they can talk if they wish. But the religious life is the only happy life, in the real sense. Again, it's a case of not grasping. Not grasping at our concepts, our pictures, our imaginary pictures of what happiness is or ought to be. It is because I cling to those that I always plunge into misery. Because every conception or assumption of the unenlightened is a faulty one. It's obvious, isn't it? And yet we are unable to live by what is really so obvious. But just try. Just let go. The trying consists in not trying to hold on to anything, to achieve anything. And when you let go, life is there. The body itself will teach us all this if we only let it, and if we just learn from the body and its ways. Now look, just let's spend a few moments looking into this. Once again, let the rhythm of the breath get established, and the whole life rhythm permeate the entire psychophysical organism. Just let the mind be attentive to that rhythm, that's all. Just be completely at ease. Carefree. Just rest in the strength of that inward poise. Now bring up before the mind's eye any one respect, in which we cling to something, I mean thing in the physical sense, some object, some property, possession, in which we cling to a person, or to ideas, beliefs, which we miscall faith or truth. Anyone, now just examine it, just look at it, that is, don't analyze it, just look at it. I am suggesting look at the clinging, the grasping. And then see the situation differently. The same object, property, person, idea, duty, whatever it is, let that be remain there, but see it without clinging, without grasping. Now this is important. And you may notice that when the clinging disappears, then it is the totality, transcendence, which takes charge. And one lays down the burden, or rather the burden slips off by itself, and with it goes egoism. And you will find that calm will pervade the mind, and peace will be active within the heart. That way one is a blessing in this world, here now. Stop. Just rest in that stillness and silence.